Can't Wait for Christmas is a proud member of the Christmas Podcast Network.
Hey, buddy, what you doing?
Is it Christmas yet?
No, sorry, not yet.
I can't wait for Christmas.
Yeah, I can't wait for Christmas either. In fact, let's celebrate now.
Welcome to the Can't Wait for Christmas podcast.
It's October 25th, 2024, and that means there's only 2 months left until Christmas. It also means it's the 70th anniversary of the classic film, White Christmas. To celebrate this occasion, I'll be joined by esteemed film critic and Christmas movie expert, Alonzo Duralde. We'll also tell you how you can decorate your tree and help others at the same time, and Art from A Cozy Christmas Podcast stopped by to give us his five golden things. Okay, let's start the show! Welcome, Yule Believers, to the Can't Wait for Christmas podcast, the podcast all about Christmas history, Christmas traditions, Christmas media, and everything else Christmas. I'm your host and guy whose Halloween costume is a guy getting ready to put up his Christmas decorations, Tim Babb. Yes, it's almost time for Christmas's opening act, Halloween. I mean, sure, Halloween is its own wonderful thing, but let's face it, Halloween is just warming up the crowd for the headliner, Christmas. Speaking of Halloween, it is an important date in our first segment, We Need a Little Christmas, now.
We need a little Christmas now.
As you hear at the start of every episode of this show, we're part of the Christmas Podcast Network. What started as a handful of Christmas podcasts has grown into a big old community of Christmas podcasts of all different kinds, and we basically just support each other in this endeavor of making the podcast space a little more merry. But this year, in addition to supporting each other, we're supporting those in need as well. And we need your help. Right now, we're taking pre-orders for a lovely Christmas Podcast Network ornament for your tree. It's only $25, and that includes shipping in the U.S. But the best part is the proceeds from the ornament go to the Red Sled Foundation, a group that provides programs, services, holiday gifts, and essential needs for low-income, disabled, medically challenged, and terminally ill children in their local and national communities. We'll be taking orders up until and including Halloween, October 31st, so you can get your pre-orders in now. We posted the link on our Facebook page and on our threads, and I'll definitely put the link in the show notes of this episode. Much like any group project, there's always one person who did way more work and deserves most of the credit. In this case, that is Ashley from the Magic of the Seasons podcast. Did the bulk of the work to make this ornament idea a reality. So pre-order your Christmas Podcast Network now before Halloween, before it's too late. Speaking of the network, let's move on to our next segment, Five Golden Things. All year, I'm turning my countdown feature over to the other talented and merry hosts in the Christmas Podcast Network. Last time, we had Adam from the Merry Britsmas podcast join us, and if you haven't heard our September episode, I say you jolly well should go give it a listen. But wait, finish this episode first, because I'm delighted to welcome Art from A Cozy Christmas Podcast. He's going to tell you a story, or five. Take it away, Art.
Hello, everyone. This is Art, and I host the Cozy Christmas Podcast. And often on my show, I'll read Christmas stories to invite you to take a couple of moments to sit down by the Christmas tree to relax and unwind and hear some great holiday stories from years gone by. So today for Five Golden Things, I want to talk about Christmas stories that I would recommend to help you have a cozy Christmas. And this is by no means an exhaustive list. There are many that I could not add to this list just because I am limited to only five with some honorable mentions. So here we go. My list of the coziest of Christmas stories.
Number five.
Victorian ghost stories. Now, you might think, wait a minute, ghost stories, isn't that better for Halloween? And in America, yes. But back in the day during the Victorian age, one of the traditions they would have is to stay up on Christmas Eve telling and reading ghost stories. And in fact, that could be why one of the most famous of all Christmas stories, A Christmas Carol, involves ghosts, because they would tell ghost stories on Christmas Eve. I don't necessarily have a favorite short story that sticks out, although The Signalman by Charles Dickens is a story that he wrote for a Christmas publication. It has nothing to do with Christmas, though, but it's a proper spooky ghost story in and around an old train depot.
Number 4.
Old Christmas by Washington Irving. It was first published in 1876, and it's a collection of 5 short Christmas stories or sketches. Irving is invited to a friend's estate to celebrate Christmas in the old-fashioned way. It shows a lot of traditions and ways they would celebrate the season and a possible appearance from Saint Nick himself. And as a special invitation to the Can't Wait for Christmas podcast, if you are interested in this story, I will be reading it on my podcast coming up probably in November or December sometime. It's well worth the read and a lot of fun and an interesting bit of American history.
Number 3.
We're going to fast forward the clock and come to more modern times. And number 3, I'm kind of cheating because I'm recommending 2 books, but only because they're part of a series. The series is written by author Matt Haig, and the first book is called A Boy Called Christmas, and the second one is called The Girl Who Saved Christmas. 11-year-old Nicholas, nicknamed Christmas, has received only one toy in his life, a doll carved out of a turnip. But he's happy with his turnip doll because it came from his parents, who love him. Then one day, his father goes missing, and Nicholas must travel to the North Pole to save him. Along the way, Nicholas befriends a surly reindeer, bests a troublesome troll, and discovers a hidden world of enchantment in the frozen village of Elfhelm. But the elves of Elfhelm have troubles of their own. Christmas spirit and goodwill are at an all-time low, and Nicholas may be the only person who can fix things, if only he can reach his father before it's too late. This book, it's so beautifully written, and it's funny, and yet very heartwarming, and at times very sad. But Matt Haig just has written an incredible story to be topped only by the sequel called A Girl Who Saved Christmas. The Girl Who Saved Christmas is about a poor Victorian young girl named Amelia Wishart. Her mother falls very ill, so she is sent to the workhouse to work under the cruel Mr. Creeper. This has a very strong Dickensian flair to it, and in fact, Charles Dickens himself is a character who, a minor character that appears in the story. I read these books aloud to my kids. They loved them both. They are family-friendly, at times genuinely sad, but with genuine laughter and bursting with Christmas cheer. For A Boy Called Christmas, I would suggest the audiobook. It's read by Stephen Fry. His heartwarming voice and cheeky sense of humor is just a perfect blend between actor and story.
Number 2.
The Christmas Hirelings by Mary Elizabeth Braddon. Now, Mary Elizabeth Braddon was a Victorian writer who was more well known for mysteries and thrillers and what many would consider to be not necessarily the heartwarming holiday stories. But she wrote this short novel. It's only about 130 pages long, depending on the edition. And it's about a man named Sir John Penlyon. He's an old widowed man, and he lives alone, and he has no family close to him. And as he's spending Christmas with his friends, they point out that Christmas is quite dull without children around. So they have this idea that they will hire some children to come to their home and bring the joy and excitement of Christmas. Now, Sir John Penlyon is kind of a Scrooge-type character. He's grumpy. He doesn't enjoy children. And of course, the 3 siblings who are brought into his household upturn everything. And his heart is touched by especially the littlest of them. Her name is Moppet. She's a sweet and endearing character that would melt the heart of many a Scrooge. Now, as a Victorian novel, this can get a bit sentimental and at times maybe a little bit too much. But if you can't read an overly sentimental story like this at Christmas time, when can you?
Honorable mentions.
I'm going to suggest a whole genre for honorable mentions, and that is read a cozy mystery. The reason why I recommend it is that cozy mysteries are, by nature, cozy. Just about every cozy mystery series has at least one book that takes place at Christmas time. Many of these stories can be read out of order, so you don't have to read, the 5 or 10 books that come before it. in order to figure out what is going on in the story. If you are a diehard Christmas fanatic and you say, I want my cozy mystery series, I want to start with book one and I want the whole series to be about Christmas, let me tell you, that is not an impossible task because there are several mystery series that are based entirely in and around Christmas. A few of them are the Year-Round Christmas Shop mystery series, and that tells a story of a woman named Mary who runs the Mrs. Claus's Treasures in the town of Rudolph, New York. Another one I recommend constantly is the Mrs. Claus mystery series by Liz Ireland. That takes place at the North Pole. Mrs. Claus is the main character. She solves mysteries. Incredible world building and a fresh twist on the Santa Claus mythos. And then there's the Christmas Tree Farm mystery series that is also a wonderful, heavily Christmas-influenced series of mysteries. These and many others I highly recommend. They make for a great honorable mention.
Number one.
This should come to no surprise if you've even listened to half of one of my episodes. It is A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. And for number one, why not go big, right? This is the granddaddy of all Christmas stories. This is the one that inspired a nation to love Christmas again, if you believe certain reports. And you know what? I do. This is a book that has been translated into just about every language, that has been filmed multiple times, sometimes multiple times a year. Your favorite TV show or series probably has some kind of a twist on A Christmas Carol story. It is so well known, so why not read the original? I think you'll still find some surprises in it. It surprises me how many people have not actually read the story. So you should at least try and read it once, or if you're like me, have read it more than 25 times. That's how much I love this story. It's full of such Christmas cheer that though I've read it so much, I've practically got it memorized. I keep coming back to it year after year because of the power of the story. And no matter how many movie versions you've watched, I know you'll find something new in the book. So that's my selection of five of the coziest Christmas books that I would recommend. Have you read any of them? I would love to hear from you and what you think about it. And I'd love to see you over on my podcast. You can find my podcast on any major and a few minor podcast platforms, as well as going to www.cozychristmaspodcast.com. And remember, let's honor Christmas in our heart and try to keep it all the year.
Thank you, Art. Books and stories are definitely a part of Christmas that I don't cover nearly enough on this show, so thank you for helping to correct that. You can hear more of Art on his show, A Cozy Christmas Podcast, which you can find on your preferred podcatching app, or you can find a link to the show in the show notes of this episode. Now, 2024 marks a very special Christmas anniversary, the 70th anniversary of the film White Christmas.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, with every Christmas card I write.
So to celebrate, I'm happy to welcome a special guest.
Good to be here, baby.
Alleged ghost of Bing Crosby, what are you doing here?
Well, it's the anniversary of White Christmas. It's almost Halloween. I'm the ghost of Bing Crosby. It only makes sense that I'll be your guest today, baby.
No, I've got an actual film expert who's coming, so can you get out of here, please?
Hey, the more the merrier, baby. While we wait, I can tell you the story of how we cast Danny Kaye. You see, originally, the studio wanted... Wait, who are you calling? The film expert?
No, I'm calling experts in another field.
Oh, wait, what other field?
Thanks, guys. Okay, ghost busting aside, we can move on to my actual guest. I got the guy who literally wrote the book on Christmas movies. Yes, the author of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, the prolific podcaster you can hear on Linoleum Knife, Maximum Film, and Breakfast All Day, as well as the chief U.S. critic for Film Verdict, Alonzo Duralde. Thank you for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And not only did you write the book on Christmas movies, you also wrote with the Deck the Hallmark guys, the I'll Be Home for Christmas movies. because I know you're part of that team.
Yes, the guide to Hallmark Christmas cinema.
Exactly. And you have a new book out this year, Hollywood Pride, a celebration of LGBTQ plus representation and perseverance in film. That is not Christmas related, but an excellent Christmas gift idea.
Why, yes, it is.
So throwing that out there. So thank you again. Thank you for coming on the show. I wanted to talk to you about White Christmas because I know you're a fan.
Yes, it is definitely, you know, there are movies that are in the every 2 year, every 3 year rotation, but I'd say White Christmas is a pretty steady every December watch.
So you did you grow up with it or did you discover it later?
I saw it maybe once or twice as a kid, but it wasn't a staple in my home. It was really, I think my husband, Dave White, was a big, big fan of it. And he kind of turned me on to it as far as, you know, making it a tradition. And over time, I have come to love it as much as he does.
That's always cool when, you know, as a couple, you can find something like, here's my thing that I like. And then you're like, oh, I've seen that. But now that I see that with, you know, through your eyes or, right, you know, with you and see your appreciation for it, I can appreciate your appreciation for it.
Yeah, no, we're constantly bringing, like, you know, like he brought me to the musical Scrooge of 1970 with Albert Finney. I brought him a desk set with Hepburn and Tracy. So, you know, it's always a good give and take.
Well, and my wife got me into the Hallmark movies.
There you go.
So, I was at the movie theater watching, probably Beetlejuice or something, and I saw that they were like, oh, for the 70th anniversary, we're going to do a screening of White Christmas. I'm like, well, I have never seen this movie. So since it's the 70th anniversary, I should probably look into it. You know, seeing as I do a podcast all about Christmas, it's probably embarrassing that I haven't seen it. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about, like, first of all, how it got, because the song White Christmas predates the movie White Christmas by quite a bit.
Right. Although it also, of course, comes from a movie from Holiday Inn, you know, won the Academy Award for that. And the song White Christmas has a fascinating history. There's, in fact, an entire book about that I would recommend. But, you know, it becomes, you know, it's introduced in Holiday Inn amongst a bunch of other really terrific Irving Berlin songs. And then right as America goes into World War II, it becomes this sort of one of the big songs of the war. So like if World War I was all about, you know, over there and it's a long way to Tipperary, like White Christmas was that sort of keep the home fires burning song for Americans, where it was about, you know, the ones I used to know. It's a song about nostalgia. It's a song about being together at the holidays. And for a lot of GIs, for a lot of their families who were, you know, missing them on the home front, that song became very iconic in that moment. And so it then makes sense to, you know, repurpose that song into a whole other movie, you know, a decade or so after the war is over.
Right. Because it was huge. Like, it was they say now it's like the biggest selling song of all time still, I believe.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say it was the Mariah Carey's All I Want for Christmas Is You of its era, but bigger, you know, I mean, like, we're talking the Beatles, Elvis, whatever, like White Christmas is the biggest single of all time. And if it has been unseated by anything, it's been by Mariah Carey. But yeah, it is a kind of cornerstone moment of American pop culture that has, you know, never gone away.
So I'm sure the studio was like, or, you know, the people behind the scenes were like, well, we have this thing, but it's attached to this movie that's not really a Christmas movie. So they're like, well, we're leaving money on the table if we don't make this into, you know, to make a movie around White Christmas.
Right, exactly. So, So Irving Berlin is like, sure, I would love more money. And I'm going to write a whole bunch more songs to go with this new movie. And the thing is, it is one of those films that had a bit of a tortured history. You know, like you hear, for example, that, you know, when Casablanca was being filmed, like, they were still writing it as they were shooting. And so, like, Ingrid Bergman spent most of the shoot not knowing who she was going to wind up with at the end of the movie. Coincidentally or not, the director of Casablanca, Michael Curtiz, is the director of White Christmas.
I was just going to say that was such a great pull. There's a connection.
I know. What are the odds?
It's almost like you're a film buff.
Exactly. I've been accused of worse. So then it becomes this thing where, like, they they bring in they want to reteam the original stars from Holiday, and it's going to be Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire, and then Fred Astaire drops out.
Yes, and I heard two things. I heard two things on this.
Mm-hmm.
I heard when I was doing research for this, one of them said Fred Astaire thought he was just too old.
Right.
And didn't want to do it. And another one said he read the script and thought it was crap. And that's why he didn't want to do it.
And then they subsequently rewrote it
after that.
Yeah, it is entirely possible that both of those things are true. But yeah, so Astaire drops out. And then for a while, Bing Crosby drops out because his wife Dixie dies. And he's like, oh, mm-hmm. I don't know that I want to go back to work yet. But then finally, he's back on board. They pair him with Danny Kaye. They bring in a couple of guys who had written like the most recent Danny Kaye movie. And they have something like 8 weeks to write the whole thing. So literally, sets are being built and costumes are being created while these two guys are like in a room somewhere trying to figure out a plot that makes White Christmas work. And, you know, the script might not be the high point of this movie, but it works. And there are a lot of memorable kind of one-liners and you know, kind of bits of repartee between, you know, certainly between Crosby and Danny Kaye. You know, that it holds the thing together. It's at least enough of a connective tissue to get you from one big musical number to the next one.
Right. Which was the main point of these things back then.
I mean, yeah, pretty much. You know, obviously there are people who got away with doing both, you know, and there are great films that do both. But for the most part, this was like, how do we, you know, what is a framework on which we can hang all of these new Irving Berlin songs? And one of the things that I think is one of the film's best ideas is they're sort of playing on this notion, like I said, during World War II, the song White Christmas was kind of like our national, you know, sort of healing song of, you know, people being torn apart. And so the movie then becomes an object of nostalgia for World War II itself. You know, the song that had once, you know, made soldiers overseas think about, you know, their Christmases of their past and the ones they used to know. You know, now the movie itself is like, remember World War II and how awesome that was? and so, you know, the film opens with, you know, we're in the European theater of battle. Like, they have built a little rickety stage in the middle of a battlefield with a painted backdrop of a Vermont winter, and Bing Crosby sings White Christmas. And then at the end of the movie, we're in an actual inn in Vermont, and they're singing in front of a painted backdrop of the European theater of war. That is pretty brilliant, I think, as far as, you know, giving you a yin and yang moment.
I hadn't even picked up on that second part. With the painted European theater of war in the towards the end of the movie.
Yeah, it's a we call it a bookend, Tim.
Yeah, that is. I will say, like, despite this film being like huge in the like Christmas landscape, I somehow knew nothing about the plot of the movie.
Well, so, and that's probably just as well.
So when it starts, I'm like, oh, this is a movie set in World War II. And then they're like, oh, everybody, we sure love this general guy. And I'm like, okay, so it's going to be a movie about, you know, how they have to get along because this general guy is leaving and this new guy is taking over. Like, that's sort of the pretense of the scene at the beginning.
Right.
And then Bing Crosby almost dies. Danny Kaye saves his life. And then Danny Kaye wants, like, I guess Bing Crosby is kind of playing himself if he had been in the army, like he is a popular singer.
Right. Yeah. The idea is that Crosby's character is a big time, you know, you'd pay $6.60 or even $8.80 to see him, you know, in New York at a nightclub. You know, he does a single. But now that Danny Kaye can sort of guilt him over the having saved his life, suddenly now they're a duo. And Danny Kaye, you know, kind of attaches himself Remora-like to Bing Crosby, and the two of them become even more successful. But they're in a way, you know, you always get the sense that Crosby is kind of stuck with Danny Kaye, but happy to be stuck with Danny Kaye.
Yes. And well, that's the thing. So like, it then jumps, like, now the war is over and now they're back in America, and like, it's a montage of them singing and doing, you know, and like, years are going by. I'm like, oh, this is not a World War II movie anymore. I thought for sure. And like, and so then now Danny Kaye, who has guilted Bing Crosby into working with him, you know, like, and every time he starts to argue, he like grabs his arm where he hurt himself after saving Bing Crosby's life. I'm sorry, I'm not using character names.
One is Phil and one is not Phil. I can't remember. Wallace and Davis, that I remember.
Well, now Danny Kaye is tired of working so hard, so he's trying to get Bing Crosby married off.
Yes.
And so then these two sisters invite them to watch their act because, again, they're super famous now. And so the sisters want to be, well, one, the younger sister.
Vera Ellen.
Right. Invites them under false, semi-false pretenses.
Yes.
And Rosemary Clooney, the older sister, you know, is not happy about it, but they perform and the, you know, and now clearly Bing is interested in Rosemary Clooney.
Yes.
But
now a quick sidebar here. The pretense by which the two of these guys go to see the sister act is they get a letter from an old army buddy.
Right.
And we see a photo of the old army buddy. And do you know who that actor in the photo is?
I remember hearing people go, look, this person. Oh, was it Alfalfa?
It is Carl Alfalfa Switzer.
Yes.
who also is the guy who is Mary Hatch's date at the dance in It's a Wonderful Life, who opens up the floor so that George and Mary fall into it.
Wow. He is almost a part of two gigantic Christmas movies.
Yeah. He shows up very briefly, but you know what? He gets to count them in his filmography. So Carl Alfalfa Switzer is Christmas movie royalty. Let us recognize him.
So shall it be said.
Yes.
So, at this point in the movie, I'm like, wait, why did we spend all that time on the general? Like, now this is clearly a love story. Like, I'm like, what is this movie about? And then the girls are getting kicked out of their apartment, and so they have to flee. And this is the landlord who comes in at one point. I'm like, isn't that the dude from Night at Casablanca? And I looked it up, and it totally is.
Yes, he's also in Ninotchka.
But I just, like, as soon as I heard him talk, I'm like, that's the guy with the scar from Night at Casablanca. Anyway, sorry. That, like, it's such a minor port, and I think it's even uncredited, but that was just like, hey, I just watched that.
The more old movies you watch, the more you start recognizing character actors like that, and that's part of the fun.
It was fun. So the cover for the girls escaping, Bing and Danny have to do their number.
Yes.
Like, they make sure to drop a line like, oh, our phonograph with our record on it, we've left that behind. They're like, don't worry about it. It'll be important to the plot in a couple minutes. And so they lip sync their song. Like, they did. Sorry, I'm all over the place. They sing the first Rosemary and Vera sing. I'm on a first name basis with them because we're so tight.
Of course.
they sing a song called Sisters. There were no such devoted sisters.
Sisters, sisters. There were never such devoted sisters. Never had to have a chaperone, no sir. I'm here to keep my eye on her.
Is that original for this song, or was that an Irving Berlin song that he reincorporated in this movie?
Apart from White Christmas, and then apart from the songs that you see in that montage of Wallace and Davis becoming successful, they're all new Irving Berlin songs. So, like,
oh, okay.
In that montage, you hear them do like Having a Heat Wave and Blue Skies and like these,
yes,
sort of Irving Berlin classics, and White Christmas, of course. But yeah, everything else is written for the film. The one song that was nominated for an Academy Award here, which we'll get to later, is Count Your Blessings Instead of Sheep, which didn't win. But yeah, these are all new Irving Berlin songs.
Okay, because when Blue Sky came on, I'm like, wait, is that from this movie? That can't be. I'm like, wait, White Christmas isn't even from this movie, so I don't know what to think. Anyway, so the girls had sung that earlier when we first meet them.
Right.
And so to cover their escape, Bing and Danny's not quite cross-dress, but close. And then they do a version of it, yeah, to cover the girls' escape.
It's light drag.
Just a sousson of, yeah, drag. And apparently that was something they were, like, I think Danny Kaye was doing separately. Like, it wasn't part of the script. And the director's like, oh, we got to work that in. And even during the take that's in the movie, he's trying to make Bing laugh and, yes, successfully does it.
Yeah, Bing Crosby was, you can tell, kind of grumpy about having to do it. But Danny Kaye just manages to, like, keep tweaking him until he finally loses it on camera. And, of course, that's the take they used because it's the best one.
Well, it works for the character because I'm sure Bing's character didn't want to be doing it.
And of course,
then, like,
yes.
He's like, but I love this knucklehead, always makes me laugh.
Right.
I had said before we started recording, I had promised Alonzo I wasn't going to go scene by scene, but I am stuck in the mire. Like, I swear I'm going to start going faster. So then they end up with the girls going to this inn in Vermont where the girls are booked. The sisters, I should say. They're girls. Girls sounds dismissive, and that's why I don't like
them.
Yes, exactly. It sounds dismissive, but I don't mean it to. And we get the, I would say, the only new song in this movie that is even, could even remotely be called a Christmas song. Snow.
Snow, snow.
Snow,
snow,
snow.
It won't be long before we'll all be there with snow.
Snow, snow. I want to wash my hands, my face and hair with snow.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. Yes. Yeah. Now that you mention it, yeah, it is pretty much the only one.
And even then, like, it's just a winter song. But I mean, there's plenty of Christmas carols that's what they are. But
absolutely.
And then they get there. They get to the inn and they find out the inn is not doing great because all that snow they were singing about, it's not here. It's
right.
It's one of those unseasonably dry and dry.
Balmy.
Dry. Yeah. And also it turns out that the inn that they were booked at is owned by the general. I'm like, okay, now I see where we're going.
You thought they'd forgotten.
I was like, why? And also, why do they cast such a young dude? I mean, maybe it's just my modern eye, but I'm like, his hair looks so clearly not white.
Well,
that they have just,
there's
like
something
he
about
under some baby powder.
There's something about that early Technicolor that makes his hair look kind of blue. and it just is, you know, we just have to work with that.
I mean, this was the first movie filmed in VistaVision.
Yes. And that's a whole other topic that I'm sure your listeners could not care less about.
I just like how they kept saying it. Like, I'm sure at the time it meant something, but I'm like, this means absolutely nothing to me.
Do you want the short version?
Well, yeah, you know, it's their color process, their
it's a wide screen
process.
It's a wide screen process,
exactly, to compete with CinemaScope.
CinemaScope, right? Yeah, well, because everybody was losing their minds because television had happened.
Yes.
And so people were staying home instead of going to theaters. And so everything had to become big and wide and loud and as colorful as possible. And so, yeah, VistaVision was a process where basically the, you know, when you think of somebody holding a movie camera and there's like the reel on top and the reel on the bottom and the film is going through vertically, VistaVision, the film went through horizontally. So you could make the image as wide as you wanted.
I you just like to tell them, like, you know what? In 70 years, everyone's going to be holding their phone/camera. So what we really need you to do is make it taller, apparently. Like, I feel like at some point the movie theaters are like, we're losing to TikTok. We're going to have to start making really tall movies instead of widescreen ones.
Oh, you know what? I can see it happening. And so just don't even say it out loud.
Oh, sorry. Stricken from the record. So since there's no business at the inn, the sisters and Bing and Danny decide they'll bring their show there and that'll get people to come to the inn, which seems like a great idea. Except I don't see money change hands at any point. I'm spoiler alert, at the end of the movie, when they do finally get people to come, I'm like, what? Yes, there are people here, but no one's paying for anything. How does this actually help?
Well, look, I mean, I'm assuming they have booked the entire hotel just for all the dancers and musicians to stay there. And so that in itself is like going to be enough to, you know, help out the general. But then apparently they have to take it even further and you know, host this big reunion.
Yes. So, now, Danny Kaye and Vera have decided that they're going to work it out to get Bing and Rosemary Clooney together. And in a classic rom-com
switch
misunderstanding. Oh, well, yes, there's that too. But like, it's one of those things where they're totally into each other. And that's when they sing the song, Count Your Best Blessings Instead of Sheep.
Right.
You're worried and you can't sleep. Just count your blessings instead of sheep, and you'll fall asleep counting your blessings.
But then after that, they're like, Rosemary gets something secondhand, and then everybody speaks about it in such a way that... What
like, 1 5-minute conversation would end the movie, so of course, like, we can't have it.
If anybody had used a proper noun or a different verb,
we could all go home.
Exactly. But also I wanted to say the count your blessings instead of sheep number, This is one of those things that just may be the dynamic of musicals, but like, so they're talking about, they're up late by themselves and they're having a snack by the fire. And they're talking about how Rosemary can't get to sleep. And Bing is giving the advice to count your blessings instead of sheep. And then it turns into a song that they sing together, which I understand, like in the world of musicals, like, you know, sometimes you're getting to a scene and then like the emotion of the characters just becomes a song and then everybody moves on. Like, you know, we were just having a conversation. But then later in the movie, they're going to practice that song to sing on the stage, like in the show that they're performing. I'm like, so wait, so is that a song in the world of the movie? Or is that just an emotion that we are hearing via song? Like
Tim, you know how it is when you're a writer, you don't waste anything. Like, you know, that song came up spontaneously, but now dang it, it's going into the show. This is good stuff.
Good point. Good point.
I got gold here.
So then Danny Kaye, anyway, then there's the misunderstanding. So then Danny Kaye and Vera,
Ellen, they pretend.
So they're like, okay, the problem is Rosemary Clooney doesn't want to get married to Bing Crosby because Vera is not married. So she and Danny Kaye pretend to be engaged. And for some reason, Danny Kaye is totally against the idea. Like, I thought he was totally into her from the moment that they saw each other. And then all of a sudden he's like, hold on, I can't even pretend.
Well, there's this weird thing about 50s movies where, like, the idea of, you know, the swinging bachelor, you know, giving up his freedom for the little lady is presented as like a last ditch scenario. Like, it's, you know, I guess if I have to, but otherwise, no, thank you. You know, which is weird because, like, you know, I think there are certain respects in which the Danny Kaye character reads as, let's say, Faye, you know. So, I mean, there's a lot happening here. But no, I think what we're meant to understand is, you know, he is too much of a, you know, he's got too many chorus girls in his little black book to want to settle down with, you know, one woman, even if that one woman is the incredible dancer, Vera Ellen.
Which is funny because, you know, like, other than, like, I think one thing, like, he doesn't, like you say, he doesn't necessarily read that way. Like, oh, this playboy over here, I'll just women. Like, he's not a Sam Malone character.
No.
Which is my go-to, apparently.
Like early in the very beginning of the film, he's like dating some girl in the chorus. And he tries to set up Bing Crosby with her friend, who is played by the great Barry Chase. And I think one of the funniest people in this movie, I like that. Not so much as a kiss my foot or have an apple. You know, she's brilliant.
Oh, I did forget the one when Danny Kaye is talking to the two sisters when they first meet. I'm not even going to try and quote it, but he has such a funny, awkward line.
Mr. Wallace was just saying how remarkable it was that Benny Haynes' sister should have eyes. I mean, blue eyes. That is, eyes. Nice out.
I love it when a really old movie can make me laugh out loud, and that totally did. I'm like, I have to pause this for a second. Maybe it's because I can relate to being awkward around women, but that was just a beautiful bit of comedy.
But yeah, the idea that he's not into Vera Ellen is weird, given that the very first time they met, they launched right into the best things happen while you're dancing. So,
yes!
The best things happen while you're dancing. Things that you would not do at home come naturally on the floor.
The false engagement doesn't work. Rosemary Clooney full on leaves and somehow already gets a show like within a day. Like, her name's in the lights and she's in. She's got a contract and a show in New York.
And they've had rehearsals and everything.
Exactly. But yeah, there's four dudes with choreographed dancing. I'm like, didn't this happen 24 hours ago? It's like Enchanted. Does everybody know this dance?
And by the way, you know who one of those guys behind her is, right?
I do, but I'd rather you say it.
Is Academy Award winner George Chakiris, best known for West Side Story. Yes. One of his early gigs as a dancer is one of the backup guys. And as a friend of mine pointed out, it's funny that you have earlier in the movie, you have Danny Kaye doing this number called Choreography, which is sort of making fun of the kind of like Martha Graham and sort of, you know, post-World War II modern methods of dance, and the guys that are behind Rosemary Clooney are kind of doing choreography as opposed to the sort of old school hoofing that the number is celebrating.
I mean, if Hollywood is nothing if not having its cake and eating it too.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And I mean, like, Irving Berlin was very famously conservative about a lot of stuff. Like, he hated the fact that, like, Elvis had a hit with White Christmas. You know, just he was very persnickety about a lot of things that were changing in the world. But what are you going to do?
So Bing goes to see her. We get another musical number that has absolutely nothing to do with Christmas. Not that it's not lovely, but it does.
Hey, she mentions winter.
Oh, fair enough. Boom. Rubber stamp it.
My one love affair didn't get anywhere from the start. To send me a Joe who had winter and snow in his heart wasn't smart. Love, you didn't do right by me.
They still don't work it out. But so the thing was that she thought she was led to believe that that Bing Crosby was going to turn the performance at the inn into a big live televised thing for publicity for himself.
Yes.
And make
the general look pathetic.
Right. But in fact, what he's going to do is get on TV and get all the people from their old unit to come to the performance to pay, you know, to honor this general and for all that he's done for them. And
right.
And so, but so then Bing, so they still don't work it out, but then Bing goes on TV and Rosemary Clooney sees it. And I don't know how she's able to, other than they don't specifically say we're going to film it. Like, I don't get how she's like, oh, wait, everything I believed is wrong based on. Based on what he says, I'm like, I still think like she could still believe the same, like
both
the
could
same
be true, right?
exactly. But whatever it is, it's enough. And she heads back, and all of a sudden she's back in the show, even though she hasn't been rehearsing for days.
Hey, look, and she clearly doesn't need it. If we learn anything from the New York thing, like she steps off the train and 5, 6, 7, 8, ready to go.
It reminds me of the climax of the Muppets Take Manhattan, where
exactly.
Kermit is on his way to the stage, and the other Muppets are like, hey, some of our friends want to watch the show. He's like, no, they're not going to watch the show. They're going to be in the show. And then literally the curtain goes up seconds later, and there's props, costumes, all of them know their lines and choreography. I was like, the Muppets should do everything, clearly.
It's a musical. We just accept these things.
All right. I got you. I should just make that a note for my life when watching musicals. And then so the general is indeed surprised when all the, because apparently everybody had to happen to be tuned to that channel watching that show. And so, like,
well,
a bazillion...
I mean, they're passing it off like the Ed Sullivan Show. And pretty much at that point in time, everybody was watching it.
Oh, all right. Fair enough.
There were only three channels, you know.
All the troops do show up. Somehow the general is kept from knowing that they're there until he walks out.
Yes.
They do a salute to him, and then they do the show. And then finally we hear the song White Christmas again, which we only heard like a couple bars of at the beginning. But then they do this huge climax number.
Of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know.
Oh, I wanted to say I really liked the Santa outfits that both Gene and not Gene, Danny and Bing wore.
The reds in this movie are eye scorching. Like I love the Technicolor red, like their Santa outfits, the red dresses that Clooney and Vera Ellen are wearing. Like it, they just not found in nature, and I can't get enough of it.
I was watching some of the, I just this summer, coincidentally, I bought this as a Blu-ray at a garage sale.
Mm.
And I was watching some of the behind the scenes thing, and they said the costume designer really liked dressing men more than women. Rosemary Clooney said this in one of the interviews that was on the disc. Huh. She's like, she didn't really like dressing us, but she really liked dressing the men.
That's weird. I mean, it was, you know, the legendary Edith Head did the costumes, and you know, she did both along the way. But I mean, I'll take Clooney's word for it. It was her first movie, and I'm sure she was, you know, very receptive and alert to what was going on.
And the same extra feature that someone pointed out then in the everything good happens while you're dancing. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that right.
The best things happen while you're dancing.
Thank you. That Danny Kaye, like his suit, like his jacket, pants, socks, and shoes are all the same color. So yes. While he's dancing, there's never a break in the color. So like, you know how like a lot of, well, specifically like Michael Jackson, like he has really bright white socks right. to really draw, to break the black between his pants and his shoes to really draw attention to his feet. Whereas it was just one flowing bit of color. I was like, oh, I mean, not even something I would have put thought into, but I'm like, once you, someone's pointed it out to you, you're like, oh yeah, that is clever.
Yeah, there are a lot of little touches like that along the way. Like you'll notice that almost all of Vera Ellen's outfits have this fairly high neckline, like almost coming up to her chin, and it just sort of accentuates like how aquiline she is. But her dancing in this movie, I mean, is a feat of athleticism. I mean, you know, you watch her do this stuff, and it's like, God, lady, how much did you rehearse? You are killing it here. And this is back in the day where dancers really rehearsed and really got good at this so that you could have long takes of them. So many modern mm-hmm. musicals, they edit like mad to kind of hide the flubs. But when the camera stays on somebody and they're just dancing for a solid like 30 seconds a minute, like that's some real precise work there.
Yeah, and exhausting. Like I've taken a little bit of dance back in the day when I had a body that could handle it somewhat. And I did ballet for one day and my legs were like, I will kill you if you try this again.
Yeah, no, it is tough stuff. And she was apparently quite the perfectionist. So she really poured herself into it.
So then White Christmas, and that's the end of the movie. I did skip one scene, but I figure we can talk about it now and sort of the legacy of this movie. I skipped several scenes technically, but there's a song, I believe it's called Mandy.
Yes,
Everybody Loves a Minstrel Show.
Well, yeah, let's go back to Holiday Inn because this all kind of operates in context. No, and also the fact that like Irving Berlin was, you know, not born in this country. He emigrated, and a lot of the what they call the Tin Pan Alley, you know, musicians and lyricists of that period, the guys who were writing the big hit songs of like the 1910s and 20s. They loved minstrel shows. They thought they were super entertaining, and they had no cultural context for them because they, you know, had not grown up in this country. And so that's mm-hmm. where you get like Al Jolson in The Jazz Singer, which you look at now and it's like, oh no, let's not. But at the time, it was this very popular form of entertainment, and it was still holding on in like vaudeville and that kind of thing. And so in the first Holiday Inn, you know, the premise is that Bing Crosby, like, you know, retires from show business and he opens a hotel that's only open for holidays. So every big number is related to a different holiday, which is how you get White Christmas. But he does an Abraham Lincoln's birthday number called Abraham, in which Bing Crosby and the female lead of the film perform in blackface. And it is as difficult to look at as you might imagine. And it's why Holiday Inn doesn't get the TV play that White Christmas does.
Yeah, yeah.
By the 50s, they figured out they had to kind of thread the needle a little better. So, yeah, there's a whole song about, I love a minstrel show. And then they do the song Mandy, but they don't do it in blackface. So it's like they're teetering on the edge, but they don't ever like, They just assume you know what a minstrel show is, and we know what a minstrel show is, but we're not going to do a minstrel show, and we're just right. going to do this great, oh, and look at that tap dancing, you know. So, yeah, you could watch it. Those scenes, I think, are fine in White Christmas, and, you know, if you're showing it to kids and they ask about it, obviously you then have to give them this complicated and tortured history of American pop culture. But White Christmas does not fully commit the sins of Holiday Inn in that regard.
Right. Yes. And I will say, though, like I'm watching, I'm like, whew. Like it's the equivalent of like, cause it's like, oh, I sure miss minstrel shows. And it's like the equivalent of like, man, I miss telling racist jokes at work and like just making a whole song about it.
No, believe me, you're not wrong. But I think at the same time, like, I mean, not to give them too much credit here, but I think that like that Irving Berlin's approach to this was cultural, but also ignorant at the same time.
Right. Oh, sorry. I get like, oh, I don't want to be offensive, but I miss doing the offensive thing because it's not offensive to me. Not in a mean-spirited way. Like, oh, I miss offending people.
Like, I miss doing the thing. I didn't realize it. Yeah, that kind of thing.
He's not missing it like he's an edgelord on, you know, Twitter. He's missing it in that, like, well, the songs and the dancing and the jokes. I loved them so much, you know.
Right. Yeah, like, I miss the character of Apu on The Simpsons, not because I really love offending, you know, Indian people.
Exactly. But because I didn't, because in my limited cultural space, I don't understand why other people have a problem with this.
Exactly. I mean, I intellectually understand, but the kid in me who watched The Simpsons growing up had no idea.
Exactly.
But I will say, as soon as the number was over and they cut to because it's a huge, like, there's tons of people, there's like this huge set and there's costumes. I mean, obviously it's a movie, but I mean, like, it's just very elaborate and choreography, and like they're really throwing their heart into it. And then they cut and there's just three people in the audience. That's another one that made me laugh so hard.
Because it's a rehearsal, Tim. They pulled out all the stops. But yeah, no, go back and watch that number, because literally it ends with like Vera Ellen being sort of like passed down a row of dancers, sort of head over heels
yes!
downstairs. It's insane, and I'm here for it.
And then just the juxtaposition of like, well, there's three people watching this. Like, yeah. But they're putting their all into it.
Yeah, good job, you guys. Just do it that way on opening night.
Yeah, like I obviously have never been in that level, but I've rehearsed a couple plays before, and I feel like no one's going that hard for three people in the audience.
Right, and again, you know, the sisters weren't even part of this show before; like, they just showed up.
They're like, "Oh, I got this." It was the standard flip down. Yeah, I got. Yeah.
Can do.
So to wrap up here, I wanted to talk sort of about the legacy of White Christmas.
Sure.
As a movie. And I'm going to start with a hot take.
Okay.
And I sort of alluded to it. People love to argue about whether or not Die Hard is a Christmas movie. I would say it is more of a Christmas movie than White Christmas actually is. And I don't mean that it's necessarily a dig against White Christmas.
Sure.
But I feel like, you know, especially knowing all the script problems they had going into this, I feel like they just had a script about saving somebody, you know, like, oh, I got, like, these guys have to save their old army buddies in and also fall in love at the same time, but I don't have a hook for it. And they were like, what if we put White Christmas at the beginning and end of it? You did it, Johnson. Let's go. Let's get to work.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. I think there's a lot of the plot that could work at any time of year and tied to another holiday or no holiday or whatever. I think it is it's a combination of factors. Like, winter obviously does key into the plot, so that makes it easy to make it a Christmas thing. There is the, not exactly a redemption storyline, but the you know, there's this whole thing of like doing this good deed for the general so that he knows that his efforts haven't been for naught, that he hasn't been forgotten, that he hasn't been shoved aside, you know, as the world has changed since the end of the war. And so that, I think, gives it a sentimental oomph, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of homecoming, which is a very popular Christmas trope, even though no one's coming home and this are just all they're actually dragging a bunch of GIs and their wives away from their homes on Christmas Eve to come to this inn in Vermont. But yeah, so I point taken. I think it isn't necessarily like swimming in Christmas, but over the years when I have this conversation with people, like, is this a Christmas movie, is that a Christmas movie, I've gotten to the point where I'm like, if you think it is, then it is, you know. Mm-hmm. I know people who think of The Sound of Music as a Christmas movie just because they would always watch it at Christmas time, even though there's not a second of Christmas anything in it, apart from My Favorite Things, which has since become a Christmas standard, but that's a whole other conversation. I think you did a show about it already.
I did, actually,
you know. So it's like, yeah, okay, sure, fine, you know. I've given up on the Die Hard argument. If you're not already on board, like, there's no convincing you. And, you know, but I say, yes, you know, Eyes Wide Shut is a Christmas movie, and The Lion in Winter is a Christmas movie, and Less Than Zero is a Christmas movie. And you know, you're not necessarily going to have a discussion of the birth of Christ or whatever, or presents being wrapped or whatever, the sort of, like, you know, the staple hallmark, you know, the tree lighting and the gift wrapping and the cookie baking moments. But I think there are a lot of different ways to sort of capture that, the feeling that we have about Christmas, or the reason that we go to watch certain movies over and over again at Christmas time. And so I think the cultural weight of the song White Christmas really kind of pulls the whole movie through. You do have the song Snow, And you have, you know, this notion of like snow itself being a key plot point.
And it's, that's funny because I remember when we were at Christmas Con, the first one in New Jersey, 2019, I think it was.
Yeah.
There you moderated the Hallmark writers panel.
Yes.
I believe. Yes. And one of the Hallmark writers, I'm sorry, I don't remember the name. I think it was
Julie Sherman Wolf? Or
yes. Yes. Oh, okay. Yes. I was like, I feel like Wolf is in there. But I didn't have it off the top of my head. Anyway, she was talking about how she had pitched a movie to Hallmark where the central like worry of like, oh, we hope it snow, like we don't think it's going to snow for Christmas, but we hope it does.
Right.
And Hallmark was like, nope, that we can't have the audience wondering if it's going to snow or not. Like you have, I'm like, oh, White Christmas. I can see why. Cause in White Christmas, I'm like, is it ever going to snow? Like it's on the DVD, it's on the Blu-ray box. So I assume it's going to snow.
That song's going to feel real dumb at the end if it doesn't. But
well, I mean, I guess technically the song is about not having a White Christmas and dreaming about it. So I'm like, oh, are they really going to play into what the song
that's
actually
true.
Meant?
Yeah.
Or, I mean, you know, when it was actually written.
Like, have you ever heard, do you know any of the versions of the song where they have like the sort of not spoken intro, but the kind of prelude to the song?
Yeah, where it's talking about being in L.A. and yes. Or not, Beverly Hills specifically.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, he kind of wrote the song as there was at least somewhat sort of satirically about being in California where it never snows and missing it. And then, yeah, it turned into this whole other thing, you know, from you know how people took it to their, you know, hearts and you know what it meant to them. So a lot of people don't include that in the version they sing, although, you know, I think the Carpenters do and Barbara Streisand, there's a few that they still include that opening bit.
You know, it's the song, because the song took on a different meaning, that like it's inconvenient that the song actually meant something else, so it's okay to just sort of like we're gonna focus on this part of the song that's you know that supports how I feel when I hear want to hear the song.
Right. And it's not like I don't think that Bing sings that part in the movie Holiday Inn. Like it was, you know, was originally composed by Berlin, but I think in the movie they just cut right to the meat of it. And it's a weird song in itself in that it is one verse. You know, like there's no, or one chorus, however you want to break it up. But I mean, it's literally like these eight lines that you repeat. There's no second verse of White Christmas. It's just what it is.
That's a good point. I hadn't really thought about it. For how long it is, there's not a lot of meat on the bone.
No. But like but what's there is churse, as Spencer Tracy would say.
It's all vibes, as the kids would say. I'm in touch with the kids.
Of course, I can tell.
Well, Alonzo, thank you so much for coming on and talking about White Christmas.
Oh, my pleasure.
Like I said earlier, if you want to hear more of Alonzo, he's on not one, not two, but three great podcasts, Linoleum Knife, Maximum Film, and Breakfast All Day. You can read his film reviews at Film Verdict. And before we go, tell him about your book, Hollywood Pride, that everybody should go buy a copy of.
Sure, yeah. It's a queer history of Hollywood on screen and off, from the dawn of silent film to Everything Everywhere All at Once winning Best Picture. And, you know, kind of goes through the decades and talks about the films and the artists who made them, and I loved doing it, and I'm thrilled that it's out there in the world, and it's you can get it as a book or as an ebook or an audiobook, which I read if the sound of my voice isn't sending you running to the hills. So yeah, check it out. But also, you know, this festive time of year, check out my books, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, and I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, which I co-wrote with the guys at Deck the Hallmark, which is another podcast that I pop into with some regularity.
Again, thank you so much for coming on the show, and happy birthday, White Christmas.
May your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be white.
That's our show. I want to thank Alonzo again for coming in and giving us his expertise. I used the term film buff early on when I was awkwardly fumbling for words, but I think film aficionado would perhaps be better. Like, I warned him that we're going to be talking about White Christmas ahead of time, but he still came in with an insane amount of details about the history and behind the scenes of this movie. I knew a discussion about White Christmas would be a million times better with Alonzo, and yet I still underestimated.
I'll put links in the show notes to his other podcasts, Linoleum Knife, Maximum Film, and Breakfast All Day, as well as a link to his new book, Hollywood Pride, a celebration of LGBTQ+ representation and perseverance in film, and his two Christmas books, I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, and Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. All of those links will be in the show notes, and you'll be doing yourself a favor if you check them out. Speaking of links in the show notes, be sure to check out Art on his show, A Cozy Christmas Podcast, and don't forget to order your Christmas Podcast Network ornaments by Halloween to support the Red Sled Foundation. Okay, that's all I got for you this time. I will be back on November 1st with an experimental bonus episode for Christmas Podcast Day. Hope you'll join me for that. And until then, Yule Believers, keep laughing all the way.
And that was Christmas 1983.
Actually, Dad, it's 2024.
Oh.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Can't Wait for Christmas podcast. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Remember, if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, aka iTunes, and email us about it at christmas@tancast.com, we'll send you a free Can't Wait for Christmas sticker. If you'd like to see the show notes or leave a comment on this or any other episodes, you can go to our official website, can'twaitforchristmaspod.com. While you're there, you'll find a link to our official Zazzle store, where you can grab customizable t-shirts, ornaments, stickers, and all sorts of other Christmas-themed items all year long. We'd love to connect with you on social media. On TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, we are Can't Wait for Christmas Pod. And on the app formerly known as Twitter, we are @ChristmasPod. We Wish You a Merry Christmas was performed by the United States Marine Corps Band, and this amazing version of Jingle Bells on the accordion was performed by the wonderful and talented Christian Nowicki. All other music and sounds used in this episode are the properties of their individual copyright holders, and they are used for purposes of commentary and review. No infringement is intended. Okay, boys, did I forget anything?
God bless us, everyone.
Merry Christmas!
And you have a new book out this year, Hollywood Pride, a celebration of LGBTQ+ representation in and perseverance. It is. Well, and I'm just so illiterate. That's the only issue with me. Well, and my wife got me into the Hallmark movies.
There you go.
The smartest one she showed me was Nine Lives of Christmas with Brandon Routh and Kimberly Sestad. I was mistakenly like, are they all like this? Because I heard they were all the same. Because this is great. And like, there's varying degrees, but I just love that movie. And then I was like, I'm willing to take a chance on the rest of these.
I would venture to guess that's a lot of people's gateway drug.
I have to say, you have an excellent podcasting voice. Well, just speak like, because it's not like, hey, you know, or, but it's also not like that NPR, like, hey, we're talking about but it's like, it's both like it has the tone, but also like there's a friendliness to your voice. It's like, I'm leaning in as I'm listening the whole time. I'm like, yes. Keep
well,
talking.
That's very sweet, Tim. I appreciate it.
I mean, it's not like you can do anything about it if it wasn't great, but you have a great voice. Yeah, you got to get to the gym and work out your voice, man.
Well, yeah, that's never happening.
Yeah. Again, thank you so much for coming on the show, and happy birthday, White Christmas.
May your days be merry and bright, and may all your Christmases be white.
See? Professional. That's how you end the show. Not with some jibber-jabber like I was doing. You can get your pre-orders in now. We've posted the link in our Facebook page and on the Threads, and I'll definitely put the link in the show notes of this episode. Did I ever say pre-orders are due by Halloween? Nope. Speaking of the network, let's move on to our next segment. It's a segment. It's like a segment, but I turn off midway through the word segment. Segment. Alleged ghost of Bill Crosby. Bill Crosby?
Hello, it's me, Bill Crosby. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.